You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 25th of January 2022 on Monocle 24.
Russia keeps everyone guessing vis-a-vis Ukraine, the enduring value and quirky delights of local newspapers, and Australia spends $20 million on a flag. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Latika Burke and Stephen Diel, will discuss all the day's big stories, and we will indeed hear about the revival of a local newspaper in Canada. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Stephen Diel, writer, broadcaster and Russia analyst, and by Latika Burke, journalist with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Hello to you both.
Good evening.
We have a bunch of national festivals pertaining to the occupants of this table to blast through at the top of this show. In Australia right now, Latika, it is, of course, Australia Day. So, though I don't think any Australians actually say this to each other, Happy Australia Day.
I've never wished anyone really Happy Australia Day, although it's something you, I think, take more notice of when you do live overseas. But unfortunately for me, the first time I tried this out when I moved to the UK, I ended up in a very dodgy place in Clapham, where there were Australians about 20 years younger than me running around with inflatable kangaroos, hats with corks, and eating amongst a lot of alcohol, violet crumbles, Tim Tams, and some other assorted Australian confectionery.
Sounds like another weekend round at my place.
It was not my ideal way to celebrate Australia Day, put it that way.
It is a weird holiday, Australia Day, which, in my understanding now, Australians mostly actually observe by spending the weeks before it arguing with each other over whether we should be celebrating it or not.
Yes, because, of course, it's very contentious to some people in Australia because it spells the arrival of the British and what then transpired for the local Indigenous populations. And, you know, there's no other way to put it. It was essentially almost, they were massacred and almost wiped out. The Australian Aboriginal population is tiny now. So it is very contentious. Every year the same views get revived and it's slowly become an enormous culture war that I don't think any side will ever retreat from.
Indeed not. Also, Latika, you get to, well, if you are inclined to celebrate, you get two goes on January 26th.
Yeah, well, kind of, because the first time I ever travelled to India, where I was born, was in January, which is the best time to travel to India because it's not too hot. And lo and behold, I woke up to celebrate, in inverted commas, Australia Day, but it was India Republic Day. And there's huge parades down Delhi. It's a big thing. They light up the airports with beautiful colours of the flag. It's actually a really enjoyable day to be in India. And I might say it's a bit more elegantly done than what we do in Australia.
And this is where, Stephen, you need to explain to our listeners why you are, in fact, wearing a kilt, though we did make you leave your bagpipes in the green room.
Well, had I thought, I would have worn my kilt, because I do have the kilt.
Of course you do.
And the day I have often worn it is the 25th of January, because it's Burns Night.
So it is.
And there is no argument among Scots about celebrating Burns Night. It's a very simple but enjoyable celebration. You eat a meal of haggis, tatties and neeps, which is haggis, which if you don't know what haggis is, you're missing a treat. Tatties, mashed potatoes and neeps, mashed up parsnips. Sometimes a bit of swede thrown in as well, maybe some carrot. It's delicious, I think. Toasted with whiskey. And of course, the haggis is addressed. And I have done this when wearing my kilt and taking a dagger. And there is the famous poem by Robert Burns addressed to a haggis. And whoever is leading the proceedings gives the address to the haggis and then stabs it with the knife.
Okay, well, now I'm really hungry. But we will start, and not for the first time in recent days and weeks, with the subject of Russia's intentions towards Ukraine. The United States has put 8,500 troops on high alert, which Russia has pretended to be gravely outraged by. US President Joe Biden held talks yesterday with other Western leaders and pledged total unanimity behind unprecedented sanctions. You'll have to imagine all the inverted commas there. Should any Russian boots stray across its borders. borders. Well, earlier I spoke to Ilya Ponomarenko, a defence reporter with the Kiev Independent based in Kiev. I began by asking him what the mood is like in the city.
Well, it depends on who you talk to and where you talk to people. I mean, if we're talking about social media or TV news, newspapers, politicians, in media environment in general, it's all boiling. It's nasty. It's super nervous. Sometimes it gets out of hand. So lots of speculations, lots of assessments of war maps being drawn, of war plans being discussed. So everybody's a bit nervous in this tense anticipation of what's happening, in this, you know, uneasy feeling of uncertainty if Russians come or they're not coming. But we're talking about, you know, the media space. But if we're talking about, you know, regular people in the streets of Kiev, you will see absolutely no difference at all. I mean, you have spent some time in summer in Kiev, so you'll basically feel the same vibe. It's the same busy city with lots of awful traffic, with lots of people minding their own business, you know. Restaurants and cafes are full of people. Now, we have just managed to get over with our Christmas time craze right now in the middle of January. So the life goes on here, and in the streets you will see absolutely no difference at all. It's just a usual, peaceful, busy city.
So I know Ukraine is a big country and Kiev is a long way away from where the fighting has been over the last 7 years. But just to be clear, there's no preparations, no defensive works being undertaken in Kiev, anything like that?
Absolutely no. No panic buying, no panic sprees, absolutely no demonstration other than something very usual that is very usual for Kiev, such as, I mean, rallies of small businesses, for instance, but nothing concerning, you know, the war, no panic at all.
Is it possible, do you think, that maybe the rest of the Western world is getting more wound up about this than Ukrainians are?
It is the case, actually, because of many reasons, not because, you know, the West overreacts or not because we are underestimating this thing, just because, like you mentioned, we have the war in Donbass for more than 7 years. So over this whole time, you know, the Ukrainian society, it just got used to living with this, you know. So, you know, the society just lives apart from it, the majority of the society, apart from this war zone. So right here and now, so people are more worried about their utility services bills rather than, you know, some pretty distant or not distant perspective of a big war. So, the Ukrainians are pretty practical about things.
We have heard here in the UK that the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, is due to visit Ukraine next week. And this is obviously part of a huge diplomatic initiative going on all over the world, trying to dissuade Russia from attacking. Is any of that diplomatic activity really registering in Ukraine? Is it something local media are covering a lot of or local people are talking about?
Oh, believe me when I say it. when we saw the Royal Air Force aircraft arriving in Kiev and bringing us anti-tank weapons provided by the UK government. You know, the United Kingdom has become the most popular country in Ukraine for this month, I guess. So, yeah, you know, in this time and hour, you know, every single bit of military assistance, especially when it comes to such a huge assistance, is such a timely, it's such an important assistance as the advanced anti-tank missiles were so timely. And, every single bit of assistance is hugely welcomed here in Ukraine, you know, because we are very sensitive in this regard. So I mean, I would even assume responsibility to say that, you know, we have this most popular phrase in Ukrainian Facebook, which is "God save the Queen." This is how people react on social media because it goes viral, this picture, this text about what this means, so what these missiles are, how they are produced, how they work. So yes, this is what I simply click Facebook and I see people writing these things like "God save the Queen."
Just finally then, and I don't want to ask you to predict the future as such, but do you expect anything to happen in the next few days?
What I expect in the next days, in the next weeks, a problem in month is this prolonged crisis to be continuing with lots of passionate warlike rhetorics from the Kremlin, with lots of initiatives, primarily from the United States, from the Baltics, from the United Kingdom, probably among smaller nations and less passionate nations like Netherlands, probably, or Czech Republic. So we expect even more serious military assistance, even more visits of top foreign diplomats, because, you know, it's a pretty huge political step. But I do not expect anything, you know, tangible in terms of the outcome of this crisis, because in many ways, as I believe, as far as I you know, understand the Russian mindset, the Kremlin mindset, as someone who is actually from Donbass and pretty close to, you know, the Russian mindset, you know, in many ways from the Russian side, it's about, you know, process as it is, rather than some result. So I expect it to be continuing on and on and on in Russians, you know, fueling up this tension, this warlike rhetorics, this aggressive demands towards Ukraine and also the US and then NATO, just because in many ways it is used, this whole tension, this war, this whole tense atmosphere is used for internal domestic propaganda in Russia, because it's the historical tool of imposing their power within Russians. They need to sell this war scare, this fear, this anticipation, this Cold War style atmosphere to the Russian population to distract their attention from domestic problems.
That was the Kiev-based journalist Ilya Ponomarenko. Now, whatever else happens or doesn't happen, the crisis created by Russia has already had an effect on global energy markets. Earlier, I spoke to Daniel Yergin, a Pulitzer Prize-winning energy expert based in Washington, D.C. Daniel is also the author of The New Map, Energy, Climate and the Clash of Nations. I began by asking Daniel if we are already seeing an impact on those energy markets.
Yes, energy markets were already very tight and have been tight for a number of months. I mean, you could actually say that Europe is in an energy crisis since the autumn, looking at the prices. But now you have this geopolitical risk and expectations about what's going to happen with Ukraine and Russia, very much feeding into the oil price.
Is it just about possible that that was what Russia wanted all along, that this kind of turbulence in the energy markets was the motivation for its buildup?
No, I don't think so. I think actually Russia, from an economic and an energy point of view, prefers stability. And it actually worries about prices getting too high because of what it means for longer term demand. Also, they don't want to provide price incentive for U.S. shale production to increase. I think that the main objective here is to assert Russia's sphere of influence in Eastern Europe and in particular over Ukraine. So it's very much politically driven, but it certainly has an energy component. And as those prices of oil go up, that does certainly send more dollars into Russia's treasury.
So if, as we understand it, Europe is already experiencing a variety of energy crises, how much worse could that get if Russia does decide to cry havoc and let slip the dogs of etc.?
Well, on top of where these markets are already, I think you would see prices continue to really go up dramatically. A lot depends upon whether there's an actual disruption of supply passing through Ukrainian pipelines or others in terms of gas, and the oil price would shoot up because, you know, once conflict starts, you don't know where it ends, and there'll be great concern about disruption, even if it doesn't occur. And if it does occur, it will be registered in the markets very quickly.
So just to be clear, is there a potential end point at which the consequence of Russian military action is a really significant gas crisis or a complete cessation of supplies to parts of Europe?
It's generally thought that there would not be a overall complete cutoff of gas from Russia, because Russia still has to be established that it's a reliable supplier for the future, and there are alternatives. They're not great alternatives, but there's what's called LNG, liquefied natural gas. There's gas in storage. There's a more flexible pipeline system. So I think a complete cessation is not likely, but certainly disruption. And when you have gas prices today that are four or five times what the normal price or the average price of recent years, it could really spike up again very suddenly, and emotion and panic can move a market.
Well, On that thought, and as you said, there are alternatives, even if they're not good ones. If at the end of whatever this turns out to be, there is a collective decision by Western Europe that Russia is no longer a reliable provider of energy, how far are we from where we are now to a point at which Europe would be able to say to Russia, we don't need your gas anymore?
I think it's still quite a distance, but you could say we need less of the gas because of the growth of LNG. A very important contribution to the market has been the growth of U.S. exports of LNG. And the U.S. right now, this year, is going to be a larger supplier than Qatar or Australia, the other two major countries. So that certainly is unfolding. Russia is about, currently, numbers are actually a little lower than people generally think. It's really around 30% of Europe's gas supplies. And so that means 70% does come from other places.
I mean, this is, of course, a two-way transaction. Russia is reliant on the revenue it generates from selling gas to Western Europe. And one of the pieces in play here is, of course, Nord Stream 2, this huge new pipeline under the Baltic Sea, which will link Russia more directly to Western Europe. Why do you think it is Russia seems willing to risk that? Because that does seem an option of last resort for the West, just saying to Russia, we will absorb a certain amount of cost in the short term, perhaps, but Nord Stream 2 is just not going to happen.
I think Nord Stream 2 is, as you say, in play in this crisis. And I think that Germany hasn't been explicit about it, but I think if this really does blow up into a crisis, then that pipeline, which the Russians, it's about $11 billion, it's all ready to go. It's just waiting for regulatory approval. I think it will be very difficult for that to go ahead. And I think there'll be, keep in mind that the plan on the Western side, led by Washington, but with Europeans, is for massive sanctions. And those sanctions would sweep up everything. And I think Nord Stream 2 would be caught up in that. So that would be collateral damage for the Russians.
That was Daniel Yergin, vice chairman of IHS. Now, it's obviously not possible for a geopolitical dog the size of Russia to wag its tail without knocking a bunch of stuff over. So it is also possible that events may end up disrupting global air traffic, especially that which tries to take off from Helsinki. For the last stop in our Ukraine crisis tour, I'm joined now by Elizabeth Brough, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a columnist for foreign policy. Elizabeth, first of all, how reliant on Russian airspace is Finland?
Well, if we talk about civil aviation, quite a bit. So what Russia has as a big advantage is that if you want to fly from Europe to Asia or from the US East Coast to Asia, the best route is to fly through Russian airspace. It's relatively short and it's also safe. And that goes for Finland as well, meaning that the Finnish carrier Finnair, which flies through Russian airspace a whole lot. So certainly highly dependent.
Is this a threat that we can really imagine Russia making, though? I mean, obviously, Finland is not, at least not yet, a member of NATO, which Russia might feel gives it a little bit of wiggle room.
Well, if we're talking about Russia cancelling the overflight right for Western airlines, it's a threat that it hasn't made. But we should remember that during the Cold War, the Soviet Union didn't allow Western airlines to fly through its airspace. So it's not unprecedented. There is no obligation for any country to allow other countries' airlines to fly through its airspace. So it's a tool that Russia could use, not specifically against Finland. It could use it against Finland. I think it would be unlikely to target Finland, but certainly there are many Western European airlines and European airlines in general and American airlines that fly through Russian airspace, and they would be very heavily hit by such a ban or such a suspension of flight rights.
Is it possible that this could work in the other direction, that as part of sanctions against Russia or general demonstrations of dissatisfaction with Russia, Western countries could just start telling Russia, we're going to stop flying over Russia and therefore we will stop paying you for the privilege?
That could certainly be the case. But the point is that Western airlines, they pay the Russian government that fee. So they would have to say, in support of our government's policies, we are not going to pay you anymore. We are not going to fly through Russia anymore. I think it would be highly unlikely for Western governments to ban their airlines from flying through Russian airspace, simply because it's the lifeblood of the Asia, Europe, Asia, US East Coast air travel, and Western governments wouldn't want to hurt that even more than has already been hurt by COVID. But what I think it could happen, and is actually quite likely, is that the sanctions that the West is saying, threatening to impose on Russia, will make it so complicated for Western companies to pay the Russian government any sort of fees or payments, that it will just be too risky and too complicated for Western airlines to pay those overflight fees to the Russian government. So they may just suspend their flights through Russian airspace for that reason.
Bringing this back to Finland, we have heard a statement in the last few days from Finland's Prime Minister Sanna Marin that she thinks Finland applying to join NATO is, quote, very unlikely, at least during her term. And she has experienced an amount of domestic pushback for that. What do you think are the chances that a perhaps ironic upshot of the standoff with Ukraine is that countries like Finland and perhaps like Sweden as well, and perhaps even given this week's live fire exercises in the Atlantic, the Republic of Ireland might start thinking that maybe NATO is a place we should all be?
That is a possibility. We should remember that the debate flares up every now and then. It has certainly flared up more than usual as a result of Russia saying, well, no more countries should join NATO. Well, then countries that are in a position to join NATO will say, well, who are you to tell us? And that's exactly what Finland told Russia, and what indeed Sweden told Russia as well. But the support in Finland for NATO membership is far below 50%. It has been around in the low 20s. Now it's up to 28%, but that's still far from 50%. And it hasn't reached 50% in recent memory. So if she were to say, yes, we'll certainly see to if we can join in my term, I think she might face a no confidence vote in Parliament. So I'm not surprised she said what she said.
Elizabeth Brauer at the American Enterprise Institute, thanks as always for joining us. Let's bring the panel back in. Stephen, first of all, as the designated Russia expert at this table, heaven help you, will they or won't they? What do you think?
Well, I'm going to be very BBC, I suppose, and on the one hand and on the other hand. On the one hand, one thing which worries me and thinks that they may well, the Russian troops may well be sent in. I was speaking only this afternoon, just shortly before I came on air, to someone in Moscow who tells me that the line very much being driven now by Russian TV is, the Ukrainian army is trying to squeeze and strangle that the Donbass, and we may have to protect our people in there. Which that's a worrying development if that's the line they're going to pursue.
The Sudetenland gambit, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is part of Putin a while ago has said we have the right to defend the Russian diaspora wherever they are, and he sees a lot of people in the Donbass as being Russian. That Russia has already issued in the last 8 years thousands and thousands of Russian passports to people who live there. So that they're putting forward as a possible excuse. On the other hand, one thing which has really struck me in the last couple of days thinking about it is, what has Putin got to gain at home? And I can't really see what he's got to gain. Let's go back 8 years, almost exactly. When Putin seized Crimea in early 2014, a lot of Russians said, yes, Crimea, traditional Russian territory, is once again ours. And there was a great wave of support for that move. Rightly or wrongly, but that's how a lot of people in Russia saw it. What now would be the great wave of support? We are protecting our people in Donbass. It's not going to have the same effect. And then what's going to happen? And this is, you know, I use my experience of having very closely followed the Russian war in Afghanistan throughout the 80s. What happened there? more and more you had coffins being sent back. You had guys being sent back wounded, going to all parts of the Soviet Union saying, hey, you know, we were fighting out there. We were told we were going to build schools and mend roads and so on. And we were actually fighting. And, they, you know, I've lost my legs as a result. And you had this creeping discontent throughout the country, which I've for many years I've thought was a serious factor in the breakup of the Soviet Union. The fact that people suddenly realized they'd been told lies about this for many years, and then you had Gorbachev and glasnost, openness, and more came out. I can see that happening. That if, you know, because Russian soldiers, if Russian troops go in, Russian soldiers will get killed, and coffins will be coming back, and soldiers will be coming back wounded, and they'll also be on their phones from there saying, you know, sending social media messages saying, hey, you know, we were being fired at today, and my mate's just been shot, and so on. So I can't see, I can see that Putin may well send the troops in, but I can't see that it's going to have long-term support back in Russia.
Latika, what have you made of the international response? On the one hand, it has been, well, it's given every appearance of being resolute. We are all of one mind, unprecedented responses, etc., etc. On the same time, everybody is going a mile out of their way. We've heard it from both President Biden, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and French President Emmanuel Macron, to be very clear that NATO will not be sending combat troops to Ukraine.
Yeah, well, I mean, as has already been stated, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so that's not really an option that is live and being discussed. Just before this program, Boris Johnson gave a long statement in the Commons and was asked about this, about the situation in Ukraine, and he said that if there is an invasion, that the UK will send more troops to neighbouring countries, to NATO countries. So the question about the alliance, how is it operating? I mean, interestingly, Johnson was very, very strong in his statement, saying that we will act together. The allies are all talking together. Now, we have seen some fragmentation, particularly from Germany. We had President Biden's statement last week suggesting there could be some difference about a minor or major incursion, and that that would govern the US response. But I actually think that this is the trade-off that the authoritarians have here. Every time they behave like this, they push the allies a bit closer together. Whereas, let's be honest, multilateralism has not been working very well for a good decade and a bit. But ever since the pandemic, and we are seeing now this, I think that the international community is more intent ensuring that it's no response to Crimea doesn't happen this time. And also, I think everyone is aware of the damage that was done in the Syrian Red Lines debacle and Afghanistan last year. Interestingly, in this debate, Keir Starmer, the Labour leader here in the UK, was very, very strong, saying there must be real life consequences for Vladimir Putin if he proceeds. Now, that's not something that I think a former Conservative Prime Minister, David Cameron, would have had assurances from the other side of the House.
Well, indeed not. Certainly not from Keir Starmer's predecessor as leader of the Labour Party. A final quick thought on this, Stephen. Is there potentially some relatively meaningless bone that Russia could be thrown, or that Russia would be happy enough with, that it could go back to its people and say, ha-ha, we have stared down the West, we have won a famous victory, we now own, I don't know, 20 hectares more of potato patch in Donbass than we previously did, go us?
No, there isn't, because Putin's backed himself into a corner by saying that what we want is NATO to pull those troops out of all the countries where that joined it after 1997, that to say that Ukraine will never become a member. And in a way, it was a stupid thing to do, in so much as he knows those demands can never be met. We in the West respect a country's sovereignty, and if a country wants to join, it has the right to ask to join, and then it has to follow various rules and procedures in order to join. But NATO can never give those sort of guarantees. And what else is it? I can't, you know, he is the offender here. He's the one who's put 100,000 troops on Ukraine's borders. And so it's up to him to remove those troops. I can't see that the West can do any more. And what Latika was just saying, I think it's very, very important that the West does appear this time to be far more unified than it was in 2014. My one worry is Germany, to be honest, because we've already heard on the programme, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. If Germany allows that to to be brought into production, then there is a serious gap in the Western alliance.
And back to what Stephen was saying, I think one of the other problems Putin has is he's so good at finding the fractures in Western society and dividing democracies and putting culture, people against each other culturally. By him giving these demands that you must never admit Ukraine, et cetera, it actually unifies the public in a way he wouldn't have intended, because I think most reasonable Western people would say, well, no, we're never going to give in to those demands, and why should our governments? So I think he's actually giving these leaders who are quite weak at home a bit of a strength.
Latika Burke and Stephen Diehl, thank you both for the moment. You are listening to The Daily. We'll have more from our panel right after this.
Looking to start the new year on the front foot? Then why not join us this month for the Monocle Sale and ensure you're staying sharp in 2022. Check out the sale on now across all our Monocle shops around the world and online at monocle.com/shop. From collaborations with our favourite brands like Adidas, Birkenstock and Bally, to Monocle favourites and staff picks like the De Bonfacture Fine Corduroy Work Jacket and the Henderscheme Atelier Slipper. So what are you waiting for? The Monocle sale is on now, running until the 27th of January in store and online. The Monocle sale. Put your best foot forward.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Stephen Diehl and Latika Burke. And we head now to Ontario, Canada, where it has just gone 13:31, give or take. Local and community newspapers have had a particularly torrid time over the last 15 years or so in Canada and elsewhere amid the disruption to traditional advertising-led media business models. At least 250 local papers in Canada have been shuttered since 2008. But one journalist is hoping to buck that trend. Mohsin Abbas, a Pakistani journalist who arrived in Canada as a refugee in early 2000, has revived the Tilbury Times, a weekly newspaper founded in 1883, which was closed in 2020 by its then-publisher, Post Media, which cited dwindling ad revenue. Well, here Abbas explains what he hopes the revival of the Tilbury Times might mean for Canada's other currently dormant local media titles and how foreign-born journalists like himself might play a part in their revival.
My name is Mohsin Abbas. I'm the publisher of the Tilbury Times. I came to Canada in 2002 during the Musharraf regime we had in Pakistan at the time. He went really hard on the media. So a few of my colleagues were in jail. I was one of them. So I left at the time and arrived in Canada as a refugee claimant. And I'm here since then. I work for BBC. Urdu and Punjabi section as a freelancer, and I produce documentaries. My recent was The Accused, Damned or Devoted. It was awarded the Best Investigative Documentary for Asian Media Award. I produced it for BBC, and I did many other documentaries for mainstream networks on human rights issue, women rights issue. Tilbury Time is around since 1883. It's a small, beautiful community and very tightly knit, very positive people. People were shocked when initially it was closed. It was a very sudden announcement by the corporation, but they were very excited it's coming back and they were very supportive. First, I read about it when they closed it and I said, oh, it's the same story where I grew up in a small village in Pakistan. When I say village, we have population in thousands. So I felt, I think this is my time to get involved, to do something, if we can bring this paper back. So I started researching my options and I was lucky to find the domain very close to the original name it was previously. And next morning, I started driving to Tilbury. It was about 2.5 hours from where I live right now. I live in Guelph, Ontario. And then I approached some former employees and community members. And we start talking. Over the period of 3 days, We talk to people. I want you to take them on board, not just to do something at my own and give them a surprise. They were surprised when I phoned them, and but they were very supportive and very open to support and discuss with me the history, the ideas. So January 3rd, we went live and published first story. We're looking forward to have a print edition. We're hoping for March, a limited edition. We won't be printing every week, but at least once a month. I think down the road, we will sustain on the reader's support rather than the advertiser. Because when you have an advertising site, then you miss the point. In many cases, that's the reason the big corporation closed it. If they were be able to keep the stakeholders, the readers, part of the game, paper might never have closed. So people were just told in one quick news release, oh, we're not printing anymore. Many small companies, ventures, I think are emerging and they're coming back, and we get good feedback and we get a lot of people reaching us from those towns where newspapers were published by big corporations, and they're looking to shake hand with us. It's been a great experience so far. Since the Canada is developing, is growing, right? Small towns are becoming bigger and bigger. And in those places, Canada can utilize the talent of these foreign trained journalists. Those small towns can utilize that talent. They're passionate. They left everything behind for their profession. And I think Canada can benefit big time to revive these small publications. And it's a great initiative. And I think small towns should come forward and look for these people who are looking to work as a journalist in Canada, because there are opportunities, there are people who are willing to work. So I think it's a good fit for both sides.
That was Mohsin Abbas, proprietor of the Tilbury Times. He was speaking to our Toronto bureau chief, Thomas Lewis. Let's bring the panel back in. First and foremost, what a fantastic story, which I'm sure in due course will be turned into an insufferably heartwarming Netflix drama. I really hope Mr. Abbas makes sure he gets his piece of that. Latika, are you now or have you ever been a fan or indeed perhaps an employee of a local newspaper?
You know, I started out local in media, but not in the newspaper, which was kind of the cliche. That's normally where everyone starts. But I was always attracted to broadcasting at a young age. So I started out in what was one of a handful of the remaining locally owned radio stations in Australia. And this was in a small country town, Bathurst, in New South Wales. It's about 3 hours west of Sydney over the Blue Mountains. And I love local news. I absolutely love local news. I remember reporting on things like smashed windows. Once there was an awful smell around the town for 3 days, and I started investigating, and it turned out the local sausage skin factory, which was this huge employer, had a leakage of raw sewage, and I cracked that nut, and I felt that was a really good piece of work. But these things really matter, and I think one of the best shows I've seen was Afterlife by Ricky Gervais, where there's this wonderful scene in season two where he discovers the joy of local news to people. And he basically sums it up that it's the more elegant version of I Was Here, the graffiti that you might find on the toilet block.
It kind of is. I mean, Stephen, it is common to joke, and I know there are websites devoted to it, those sort of pictures of grumpy citizens standing next to unfilled potholes or complaining about substandard sandwiches or some desperately, desperately minute concern. But Latika's right. Just as all politics is local, so is all news ultimately, and this is the stuff that does actually matter. That being the case, do you think it should be possible, as we heard Mohsin Abbas suggesting, that it should be possible for really perhaps even hyper-local newspapers to find a way to survive and thrive?
I think it should be, and I admire what he's done, and I really hope it works for him, and also maybe he gets his Netflix series. but I have to admit, I used to say that I found nothing more boring than someone else's local newspaper. And I said this once to a friend who looked at me quizzically and he said, "No, no, Stephen." He said, as an author, he was an author of novels. And he said, "As an author, it's the most fantastic thing because that gives me such good storylines." And what Latika was just saying, I can see that these are actually, if you use the news in a constructive way, it can be. But I find it no more than slightly amusing if you do pick up someone else's paper when you're visiting another area and you think, is that really interesting? But as Latika said, it probably is.
I should mention at this point that I was once featured as the cover story on the weekend supplement of the Wagga Wagga Advertiser, which is the local newspaper of the town in which I was born. And as my dad, always keen to lend some perspective to the situation, pointed out, he said, "Well, okay, Wagga Wagga Man writes book, but Wagga Wagga Man reads book would have got you page 5.
Well, I don't wish to top your story, but I did have a full page coverage once of in the Novosibirsk evening paper in Siberia.
The long winter evenings must fly by.
Long winter evenings, including photos of me with their staff. It was a weekly newspaper, and on a Saturday morning, they used to go to the banya, which is like a sauna, and so there are two pictures of me in the banya with them, wearing nothing more than a sheet.
Okay, please don't ever bring those in. Finally, on today's show, sticking with the semi-Australian theme, Australia's government has bought Australia an Australia Day present, the red, black and gold Aboriginal flag. Though the flag has been a feature of Australian life for decades and is now flown on many, if not most, public buildings alongside Australia's national flag and is indeed recognised as a national flag in its own right, copyright in the design has belonged, reasonably enough, to its designer, the Indigenous painter Harold Thomas, who came up with it in 1970. In a deal worth $20 million Australian dollars, the federal government has bought it for the nation. Latika, is this money well spent?
You know, I'm so happy to see this resolved. I think of all the millions governments spend on all sorts of crappy and wasteful things, this is a good $20 million to spend. It secures the copyright for public and fair and free use. And it's also, I think, a good reward for someone to come up with that very impactful flag and be rewarded in this way. He has gone on to say he hopes that this gift to the Australian community will cherish, something they will cherish. And there's a lot of grants and scholarships and things tied up in this as well.
We should be clear that the federal government has not just presented Mr. Thomas with an enormous sack of cash.
So I think it's been done very elegantly, and it's actually so nice to see a story where people are not fighting each other and have actually sat down in a room and come up with a sensible resolution.
Just to follow that up, Latika, what do you make of the timing of the announcement, which is, as we were discussing earlier, just before Australia Day? Is that good timing or actually incredibly tactless?
No, I think it's good timing. I think it comes at the right time. You know, for people who want Australia Day moved from its current day, which marks, of course, the British invasion as those of Indigenous Australians sometimes see it or label it that way, and indeed supporters of that community also call it that. I think it's fair and right that history is complex, it's nuanced, and wrongs aren't always righted, but we can certainly acknowledge them and continue telling a better story.
Stephen, to broaden this conversation out, do you have a particular favourite alternative national flag or unrecognised national flag or something that you would rather fly in place of whatever it is that flies there now?
Well, in a way, can I tell, I should flag up, this is a joke, just in case people think. It's could do with Russia, funnily enough, that the head of McDonald's rang Vladimir Putin. And he said, "Slave Vladimir, you know, you've brought back a lot of Soviet things, and you like the idea of the Soviet Union. You brought back the old music for the anthem. I got a great idea. Why don't you bring back that Soviet flag, which of course was red with a hammer and gold hammer and sickle? But instead of the gold hammer and sickle, you put a big gold McDonald's M." And Putin said, "Oh, I will think about this." And after he put the phone down, he picked the phone up to his prime minister and he said, "Misha." Tell me, when does our agreement with Aquafresh finish? But my favourite flag has to be, I have to say, particularly today on Burns Night, my favourite flag is the Saltire, the Cross of St Andrew, which is the flag of Scotland.
Well, on that patriotic note, that is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Stephen Diel and Latika Burke. And I can exclusively reveal that the next Foreign Desk Explainer, live tomorrow on Australia Day or Invasion Day, depending on how one regards it, will look at the history and symbolism of the Aboriginal flag in more detail. Today's show was produced by Emma Searle and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow, 1900 in Zurich and 1300 in New York City. Thank you for listening.